A Tennessee disaster has raised a lot of questions about the seemingly obscure subjective regulations of coal ash. A huge amount of coal ash spilled from a plant near Knoxville last week. Happened at a utility plant run by the Tennessee Valley Authority. It destroyed nearby homes and displaced some families. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports on the substance that spread everywhere.
Coal ash is the stuff that's left over after coal-fired power plants generate electricity and strip out pollutants. Plants produce about 130 million tons of it every year.
That's enough to fill a line of railroad boxcars stretching from the U.S. all the way to Australia.
Eric Schaefer heads the Environmental Integrity Project. He's been watching the growing heaps of coal ash stored at 440 electricity plants around the country. In the case of TVA's Kingston plant, the waste had been accumulating for 50 years. It covered more than 100 acres and rose 65 feet into the air before it collapsed. Glenn Pugh is in charge of regulating the landfill.
I do think our regulations provide for the proper checks and reviews and evaluations.
Pugh manages solid waste for the Tennessee Department of Environmental Quality. He says despite the accident, he thinks the regulations were adequate and TVA was following them.
Something happened here that was unexpected.
But Eric Schaefer says the accident didn't surprise him.
We saw this several years ago in Pennsylvania. A little town named Forward Township got buried in a landslide, really a mudslide of fly ash. And we went in and tested the ash, and it turned out to be toxic, also full of arsenic, just like the TVA site.
Schaefer says disasters are waiting to happen in other places because coal ash is not subject to the strict federal regulations that govern hazardous wastes. Instead, it's up to the states to regulate it, and some don't. Most treat it like it's not toxic.
The prevailing myth is that it's safe. We have EPA sort of buying into that for many years and really refusing to regulate this material for what it is, which is highly toxic ash that leaches metals like arsenic and cadmium and mercury into drinking water and into rivers and creeks.
In 1980, Congress asked the EPA if coal ash should be regulated as a hazardous waste. In 1993, the agency said no, but kept researching the question. In 2000, it said it should be regulated, but as a non-hazardous waste. So far, the agency hasn't produced any rules. Matt Hale heads the EPA's Solid Waste Office.
We're looking into what are the appropriate ways to set federal standards for coal ash landfills and impoundments.
So basically, EPA has been studying this problem for 28 years, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Why has it taken so long?
There's been a considerable amount of technical work. Simply the processes require this amount of time.
Jim Rower of the Utility Solid Waste Activities Group says there's no need for federal oversight because states are doing a fine job of regulating the hundreds of ash pits around the country.
I think the fact that we've only seen four of these rather spectacular events over the last 50 years would underscore the fact this really isn't an epidemic problem or a trend that would call for some sort of federal intervention.
But environmentalists say they think the TVA ash slide will become the Exxon Valdez of the coal industry and force government to finally regulate coal ash storage. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. Our use of fossil fuels appears to be stunting the growth of coral on Australia's Great Barrier Reef. Scientists have predicted that the buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will be bad for coral. And as NPR's Richard Harris reports, a new study provides some of the strongest evidence yet that coral is already suffering.
Living corals literally build the reefs that support some of the most diverse life on Earth. So researchers at the Institute of Marine Science in Australia have taken a close look at corals along the Great Barrier Reef to check on their growth over the past several decades. Glenn Dieth explains they focused on big round corals known as porites.
They lay down the history of their growth in their skeleton, so just like tree rings.
As a result, scientists can measure the rings and see how fast they've been growing. As they report now in Science magazine, coral growth slowed appreciably starting around 1990.
There have been some other studies now which are showing similar effects, but this one covers basically the whole of the Great Barrier Reef, which is over 2,000 miles long. And that's a huge area, and we've found very consistent results.
Growth is slowing by about 1% per year. And if the trend continues, Dieth says this critical species of coral could stop growing entirely across the Great Barrier Reef by the middle of this century. The big question is why this is happening. The scientists point to two factors. One is increasing ocean temperatures, apparently as a result of global warming. Dieth says the other factor is that the ocean has been getting more acidic, also as a consequence of all the carbon dioxide we're pumping into the atmosphere.
So the carbon dioxide dissolves in the water becomes more acidic, and that increased acidity is what reduces the rate of growth of the corals.
That change in ocean chemistry makes it much harder for corals and other shell-building organisms to build their skeletons. I called coral expert Joni Kleipas at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado to ask her about the study. So what does this portend for corals?
Oh, it's not very good, is it? We've predicted this for a long time, and I think most of us would like to be proven wrong, and it seems like this paper is one more notch telling us that maybe this whole problem of climate change in coral reefs is really true, and we need to do something about it.
But what to do is the question. Carbon dioxide is building up rapidly in the Earth's atmosphere as we burn more and more fossil fuels. Even optimistic scenarios find that a whole lot more carbon dioxide is going into the air and the ocean in the coming decades.
It looks pretty gloomy, I have to say it. It looks really gloomy for the Great Barrier Reef, and I think there'll be major changes there.
That's Ron Salm in Hawaii, who advises the Nature Conservancy about coral reef issues. He doesn't share the gloomiest scenario, which is that corals in the Great Barrier Reef could die off entirely by the end of the century, but he expects the reef will soon be a very different place. Salm says, of course, the world needs to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, but we also need to find and preserve reefs that are relatively resilient to the effects of global warming and ocean acidification. For example, there are some areas north of Australia, in the so-called Coral Triangle, that seem to be doing relatively well right now.
We need to put in place actions that we can take today to help safeguard the reef, so that by the time the carbon dioxide emissions are under control and are being rolled back to some acceptable level, that we've got to ensure that there's something that survives.
Presuming we can someday repair our atmosphere, young seaborne corals can then float throughout the ocean and repopulate the reefs. What's coming clear is that in the face of climate change, the conservation challenges for the ocean may turn out to be even more challenging than for ecosystems on land. Richard Harris, NPR News.
People seem to be going green just everywhere these days. Schools, offices, shopping malls. But on the racetrack?
Off the banking at the exit of turn number 4, the 57 machine of the rookie, Leilani Mutter, pulls within a car length as a setup in turn 1.
Yep, even on the racetrack, Leilani Mutter is a professional race car driver and environmentalist. Now she realizes those words don't often appear in the same sentence, but says she's on a race to save the planet. She's already gathered a lot of attention from being a woman in the nation's number one spectator sport. Leilani Mutter is the fourth woman in history to race in the Indy Pro Series, and 2 years ago, she set a record for the best finish for a woman driver at the Texas Motor Speedway. She has a website, too, carbonfreegirl.com, where she chronicles her racing career and encourages visitors to go green. Leilani Mutter joins us now from member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So how do you become an eco-friendly race car driver?
Well, my background is actually in science. My degree is in biology from the University of California in San Diego. So I've been an environmentalist really my whole life. I was always an animal lover. I've been a vegetarian for many years. And the race car driving kind of came actually after my degree. And I realized there's definitely a contradiction there. But the reason why I want to use my voice in the racing world is that, you know, it's the number one spectator sport in America. It's a hugely popular sport, and we want everybody in this eco movement to go green, and you can't leave behind 100 million race fans.
Mm. Every race car team needs corporate sponsors. I wonder how our ears have reacted to some of your eco-activism.
Well, you know, when I first started speaking out about the environment on my racing site a few years back, I definitely had a mixed reaction. You know, some people were telling me that they liked to see that and they wanted to see more people talking about some of our environmental problems on the racing circuit. But then there were also others that were, you know, very negative and kind of saying I was brainwashed by Al Gore because I was permitting an inconvenient truth on my site. But the important thing that I tried to look at is I was getting them talking about it, you know, to go into a NASCAR forum and see them arguing and talking about global warming and talking about climate change and an inconvenient truth and greenhouse gases. And those kinds of things weren't necessarily taking place in NASCAR forums before that.
And you're putting together a team for 2009?
Yes, I'm calling it my Eco Dream Team, and the concept of it is instead of having one company sponsoring the car and having the primary space all over the car, I would instead break that up into smaller sponsorships from several companies, and the main spot on the race car would be a call to action message for the race fans. So, for example, one of the messages I wanted to send was about CFL light bulbs, and I would like to run a race car that has a CFL light bulb on the side of it, and I can say I have this on my race car because I'm trying to call to action all the fans that are here in the stands and all the fans tuning in on TV to change out your light bulb. And then the next race we'd run something different. It might be a race car that says no more paper, no more plastic, and then I can talk about the plastic bags and how many of them aren't getting recycled. And I'd like to have a little eco-education center that's at the racetrack, so, you know, where the other drivers are selling their hats and their shirts and their the little race cars, I'm going to be selling CFL light bulbs and canvas grocery bags and just giving them tips on things that they can do to go green.
Ms. Munter, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Leilani Munter, professional race car driver and founder of CarbonFreeGirl.com, joining us from Charlotte, North Carolina. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's been a rough year for the ranching industry. Fuel and hay prices were sky high for much of the year, and Americans are eating less beef. Many ranchers are looking for extra sources of income, and some are finding it in their backyards. Wind. Wyoming Public Radio's Eddie Goss reports.
A snowstorm plows east across the Laramie Valley toward Pep and Kathy Spicer's ranch. The wind bends the cattails and grasses. It whistles through knotholes in the Spicer's fence. It unsticks a stuck weather vane.
You learn that when you have kids, you bury the trampoline within about 18 inches, actually, of sand so that it doesn't end up in the next county, because it will.
Kathy Spicer says wind speeds in this valley can reach 80 miles an hour. Her husband, Pep, says that can be deadly in the winter.
When the temperature is 20 degrees maybe and you're getting a 30-mile-an-hour wind, it doesn't take long to chill a calf.
But about 2 years ago, that cruel Wyoming wind started to become a commodity. Strangers began to drive up the long dirt roads in this valley, knocking on ranchers' doors. They were wind developers. They wanted the rights to build wind turbines here or to sell those rights to bigger companies. Rancher Jim Rogers says some of his neighbors felt pressured to sign leases, but they didn't know what their wind was worth.
You had to be kind of careful at the first. There was a lot of wind companies out here trying to just lease up the land, to tie up the land.
A lot of those landowners, to be quite frankly, just didn't quite know how to deal with that.
Grant Stumbo is the visionary behind Wyoming's new model of wind development. Stumbo works for a state branch of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He wears a thick brown mustache, keeps his hands in his pockets, and has a deep affinity for people who work the land. 2 years ago, when Stumbo heard reports of wind developers roaming the state, he had an idea.
why can't we work together and get a better price?
To build a wind farm, developers lease large blocks of land. They usually approach many landowners and make separate deals. But Stumbo saw an opportunity to give landowners more leverage. Ranchers and farmers pool their land together, up to 100,000 acres in some cases. They work with developers as a group and share the profits. That idea can be a tough sell for many in Wyoming who value their independence and privacy. But Stumbo says the handful who join wind associations have an advantage with developers.
When you put these larger blocks of land together, that's exactly what they're looking for, so it becomes a whole lot more marketable.
Susan Williams Sloan works with the American Wind Energy Association, a trade group for the wind industry. She says wind associations streamline the process for developers.
They kind of are a one-stop shop for the developers to come to.
But wind associations often don't wait for developers to come to them. Instead, they market their blocked land to dozens of companies. William Sloan says that can lead to bidding wars. Working with associations is potentially more expensive for developers. But ultimately, William Sloan says landowners and associations are better informed. They understand their contracts. She says that's good for the landowner and for the developer. The Wyoming model is spreading to other western states, New Mexico, Kansas, and Colorado among them. Here in Wyoming, there are now 8 wind associations. One includes the ranchers in the Laramie Valley. Kathy Spicer says a wind lease might ease one of ranching's major burdens, unreliable income.
It's not like a normal job where you get paid every month or every 2 weeks or whatever. You get paid once a year.
That's when you sell your calves, and calf prices this year were the lowest since 2002, according to reports from the Livestock Marketing Information Center in Denver. Laramie Valley rancher Jim Rogers says ranchers are hurting for extra income.
Well, if we're going to continue doing this, we're going to have to look at other ways besides trying to make the old cow make all the payments.
Wind revenue should help. Grant Stumbo with the USDA says if a wind project goes ahead, turbines are built, and transmission is available, a rancher's royalties could be hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. Everyone in the wind association would get a share, even those without turbines on their land. Jim Rogers says that sounds great to him and his neighbors. As he puts it, a lot of ranchers these days have a choice to make, whether they'd rather look out at a wind turbine or at a subdivision. For NPR News, I'm Addie Goss.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Hundreds of acres in East Tennessee remain under a thick layer of coal ash sludge after a spill this week from a power plant. The Kingston Fossil plant, where the spill took place, generates electricity for hundreds of thousands of homes in the region. Coal ash is a byproduct of burning coal to produce electricity. In a moment, we'll hear whether it could be toxic to people and the environment. First, we'll hear how families in the area are coping. NPR's Tamara Keith is in Kingston, and she joins me now. Good morning, Tamara.
Good morning.
So what is this scene? The pictures look scary.
Yeah, it's a big mess. You know, the power plant is at this confluence of two rivers and a little lake, and all of this coal ash broke through the earthen dike that was holding it back, and it was just like a big landslide, except it was ash and sludge. It, you know, knocked a home off its foundation, covered roads and railroad tracks, and you know, all through Christmas Day, there were crews out there with heavy equipment trying to clean things up, but this is not a one-day project by any means.
What about the families that were in its path?
Well, there were about a dozen homes affected. Three of those homes have been condemned, and I visited with the Copeland family. Their home was fine, but their neighbors' homes were severely damaged, and they're shaken up. I mean, this slide, this flow of muck was right behind their house. And, you know, they have this beautiful house that was on this beautiful little lake, and they showed me pictures of sunsets on the lake. And now it's thick with ash. You know, they'd be better off trying to walk across the lake now than trying to swim across it as they had in the past. And here's how Deanna Copeland describes the situation.
The amount of devastation that it's caused from there here, how in the world they're going to fix this to the level that it was before, I just don't see it. And then on top of that, after they, if they can fix it, to be honest, do I trust it?
She and I were sitting in their living room looking out at their cove that is now full of sludge. And she just kept talking about her house in the past tense as if it had been destroyed. And you know, she just looks at that muddy mess and she doesn't see a future for her family there.
How did this happen?
Well, there was this big pile of coal ash and essentially it had been piling up over years and years. Coal ash or fly ash is it's the stuff that doesn't come out of the smokestack at a coal burning power plant, and it's put into a slurry and then put into retaining ponds, and then when it's dried out, it's put into a different pond and stacked up. And Chris Copeland described it as kind of like watching the pyramids being built. It got up to 55 feet above the water level in the pond, and here's what he had to say.
You think that they know what they're doing and that everything's safe, that they're keeping an eye on it. I guess they just built it up so high that it just couldn't hold itself together anymore. It just let go.
Well, Deanna and their two girls and some neighbors that also have children, they're going to go stay someplace else for a few weeks and try to figure out what the long-term plan is, because right now there isn't one. And the Tennessee Valley Authority, the power company, they've assured the Copelands and others that everything is fine. But, you know, Chris says that they've been on the internet searching around, doing research on coal ash, and you know, they're just not convinced.
You know, we're worried about living next to this ash dump now. It's, you know, just a few feet in our backyard. We've got a tremendous amount of ash. And, you know, what's in that ash? You know, what kind of contaminations in the ash? What kind of health effects?
And the spill is also affecting waterways that supply drinking water to millions of people. And at this point, there's a big debate about, you know, how much of a problem that is.
Tamara, thanks very much.
Thank you.
NPR's Tamara Keith is in Kingston, Tennessee.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. In the hill country of eastern Tennessee, residents today surveyed a vast spill of wet coal ash that swamped a dozen homes and hundreds of acres. 5.4 million cubic yards of the sludge burst through an earthen dam in the town of Kingston this past Monday. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, work crews are still struggling with the mess.
At the Tennessee Valley Authority's Kingston Fossil Plant, big yellow earth movers and backhoes and dump trucks are busy. Workers are trying to move millions of pounds of soggy ash back to the artificial mountain where it came from. The ash coats a half mile square, sometimes as deep as 10 or 12 feet. Roads are blocked, and so are the train tracks that bring coal to this power facility that serves nearly 700,000 people. The plant is still running, though at a reduced capacity. And plant manager Ronald Hall says there's enough coal to last 30 to 50 days.
We're not that concerned with coal right now. We're concerned with the impacts to the community and being able to have access to get to the other area so we can work with our equipment to get it cleaned up.
TVA's environmental executive, Anda Ray, says tests of sludge and area drinking water supplies show that this massive spill isn't threatening human health. There are concerns about what happens when the ash dries out and could become airborne. But for now, Ray says there are other things for residents to worry about.
Their issues are getting their lives back to normal. Am I going to get my aesthetics back? Is my property value going to go down? Do I have a health situation? And so those are the areas that we're putting as number one priority to address those.
Tom and Wendy Varab recently put their home on Lakeshore Drive up for sale. The house backed up to a lovely little cove and had a water view out front, too. Wendy says there was even an interested buyer.
But she was definitely going to come. She was interested. And I can't see that happening anymore. I think that she's not going to come and say, you know, oh, this is the place I want to be. Because it's not the place Tom and I want to be right now. This is just sad. It's very sad.
Their house now backs up on an almost solid lake of ashy muck. Tom Varab says it makes him think of the aftermath of Mount St. Helens.
I mean, that's what it looks like. It's ash. It's dirty, muddy ash.
With uprooted trees poking out of the sludge. The couple won't let their dogs play out here anymore because they just don't know how hazardous the ash might be. They're not entirely reassured by word from the TVA that the sludge isn't toxic.
You know, you read in the papers that, you know, there's all kinds of dangerous material in this stuff. It's hard to say, you know, we don't know if it is or not. But we definitely know that it's not a beautiful, serene water setting.
For many in the environmental community, long opposed to coal-burning power plants, this spill is a form of validation. Someone has posted handwritten signs all over the affected area that say, "Clean coal?" Chandra Taylor is a staff attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center. Even before this spill, her organization called for a ban on the type of ash storage used at the Kingston facility.
This has kind of showed us all at once this type of catastrophe. It can happen, but we need to be concerned about what's in this coal waste because it can really affect the natural environment and human health over the course of time.
On the ground in Tennessee, environmental officials are trying to make sure that the ash doesn't spread into more waterways. Paul Sloan is Deputy Commissioner of the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation.
We think it is manageable. We think that in terms of human health, we have made immediate assessment of the intakes for water supply. We're comfortable that we're okay there now. From what I would call a chronic perspective, having this ash on this landscape for long periods of time, that'll be something that we'll be looking at and we will deal with it.
Regardless of human health effects or even whether the ash is toxic or not, there's no question this spill is a mess of massive proportions. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Kingston, Tennessee.